Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the writer and musician Richard Hell. Richard Hell's books include the novels Godlike and Go Now, a collection of poems, essays, lyrics, notebooks, and pictures entitled Hot and Cold, an Artifact, Notebooks from Hell, 1974 to 1980. As a musician and songwriter, he formed the Voidoids in the mid-70s and was a crucial originator of punk with the album Blank Generation. He lives in New York City. Hi, Richard. How are you?
Hi, Jen. I always hated that. Notebooks from Hell. So that was the publisher's idea to call that little book Notebooks from Hell. And I went along with it because I was kind of insecure. It was a real early book.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so cute, and it's not really even true. I mean, man, my name is Hell, but in that period it was sort of difficult, but it wasn't that bad.
Okay, well,
anyway,
I'll take that
that's
back,
all beside the point.
Okay.
But we like to stay beside the point.
Okay. So you're going to begin with something from your new novel, which is called Godlike.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I'm going to start with this chapter from the novel. This is what I regard as this is my life's work. You know, I mean, the thing that's most important to me is writing novels. But this is a novel about poets, and it's got a lot of poetry in it. That was fun to have to make up the poetry by the writers in the book.
Okay.
So I'm going to read, for your benefit, one of the sweeter, less dirty chapters.
Okay. Thank you.
It's about an afternoon that the sort of main character in the book called T, just T as I always refer to, spends taking a walk with a girl who he's really close to named Catherine in New York in 1971, I think it is, early 70s. "Man, New York does make me happy," said T. "Yeah," said Catherine, wild-eyed. "We've already learned." This is me interrupting. This is Hell. That Catherine has spent time in a mental hospital. She's been diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic. The two of them are really close. "Yeah," said Catherine, wild-eyed. As they walked, he let his hand brush hers, and it was like walking on the moon. They'd had sex a couple of times, and Catherine had seemed frantic for it, but T'd wondered whether her abandon came not so much because she cared for him and felt safe, but because she was fleeing her brain. Then, at another time, she'd seemed to do it by decision, and he'd wondered whether the sex might be a courtesy she showed him. She knew about Paul. Paul's a guy. The thing is, kind of, the novel is sort of loosely drawn from, just as a pretext for the writing, to have some basis for a plot. The romance of Rambo and Verlaine. And Paul, in the book, is the older poet, and T is the younger poet. She knew about Paul. Looking at her made his own reality more delicate, not because she was crazy, but because he liked her so much. They stopped to sit under the trees just above 23rd Street in Madison Square Park for a minute. "I've been having problems," she said. "You have?" "Yeah." The rims of her eyes were red. "I am a problem child." "What's happened?" "The usual." "Is it bad?" "I don't know, not really." "What happens?" "Well," she began, "windows want me to jump out of them." But she still seemed as if she could start crying. "Oh, why are they there if you're not supposed to go through them?" "They're there so there's light and space instead of just blank walls." "It doesn't make any sense. What do you know? You were brought up in a cave." "Yeah, I was raised by goats." "So what do you know?" "Nothing." He stood up and did some kind of weird jig, his head bent forward and index fingers pointing up along his temples. Ridiculous as he looked, it was also grotesque enough that she might have actually been shocked. You could see that in her face. She laughed, though. They started back up Broadway. After a block, T took her hand. He smiled inwardly at his juvenile imagination. He held her hand as if it was natural, but the linking of their hands charged them so that it was like they became invisible. They could see everything with more knowledge than the things they were looking at. Catherine seemed calmed and happy. They looked in the store windows and watched the people that passed. They arrived at Times Square and looked for where to get lunch. Times Square was battered and scratched, but cozy, with the theater marquees lining 42nd Street advertising genre movies and exploitation movies and second-run double features, the sidewalks dark with furtive people looking for trouble, and trouble advertising itself somewhat furtively from the midst of jumbo, timeless-seeming neon signs, novelty shops, and games parlors. They found the tiny luncheonette tucked among the dusty tourist traps along 7th Avenue near 47th Street and took a two-person table along the wall. They opened up the sharp-edged laminated menus a guy handed them across the counter and read the listings and looked at the shiny, though faded-looking, color pictures of three or four of the place's most appetizing entrees. T saw her get stalled as she read. She was frowning at the plaque of a menu, her face uncertain and almost ashamed. T looked back at his and in a minute saw that the big picture of spaghetti with meatballs was captioned Fried Chicken Dinner. He asked, "Can I look?" and reached across and pulled her menu around, and it was the same. She smiled, but with an embarrassed look. T laughed happily, not quite fully aware. He asked, "Have you been out in the sun? You look freckly." "You sound freckly." "No, really, you could almost be someone else, the way your face is like switched on so the freckles are highlighted." "I am someone else. I don't like my freckles, don't you know that?" "You said I was like a female cardinal. Why did you say that?" "Because I like female cardinals." "I see through you, bird boy. Don't get me wrong." She looked really frightened and ashamed. They ate a little bit. In a minute, he caught her looking at him in a startled way, and she said, "Where's your arm?" "This is my arm." "I want to go," she said. "Can we go someplace quieter?" "How about Central Park or Bryant Park?" "Okay." They went outside. She said, "Everything dead is alive. Everything alive is dead. Let's go to Bryant Park. It's closer. Or do you want to get a cab home?" "I'm dreaming," she said. T pulled her through the doorway of a building and into a corner of the little vestibule in front of revolving doors. She looked at him distraught but insistently. "What do you want to do?" he asked. "Where do you want to go? Can you think of a good place?" She looked close to panic. "Do you want to get a drink?" "Yes. We need a liquor store because I don't know any place they're going to serve me around here." The drinking softened things, and they drank for the next few hours. They eventually passed out, and when T woke up, he found her writing his name in her lower belly with a razor blade, and he talked her into checking into the hospital. There were features typical of her episodes, the inanimate becoming animate, chairs being insects, and the animate, inanimate, people, mechanical. "Where's your arm? That's not really your arm." And her sense that the world was being revealed as it actually is, only free of the distortions and interpretations imposed by the brain, without hierarchies or classifications or stories, and most importantly and frighteningly, without the world having any relation to her. It was a kind of spectacular hell, with no emotion except for the sadness and panic that followed from her memory that it hadn't always been that way, that there was a more comforting state that she'd known. When she was okay, T would try to talk to her about it, hoping it might help. "You know, I think you actually are seeing things the way they are, or in a way that is more correct than the ordinary way of seeing things. But if it's agonizing and horrifying, there's something wrong with it. That's all there is to it. Truth is harmony if you're going to be alive. It may be a highly customized kind of harmony, but it's harmony. Suffering is only right as a means to an end. I wish that instead of arguing with me, you'd try to see it this way. You are not apart from things." He told Paul that one loves the person who gives oneself expression by being receptive, by being capable of perceiving oneself. Most of the time, we are only a little alive, like a book in an obscure language. But because of those who can read us, who understand us and what we are signifying, we are brought to life, and we love them for realizing us.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the writer Richard Hell. He's reading from his new book, Godlike. So, Richard, I want to ask you about this new novel. It's your latest work, even though we want to get to poetry, too. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm thinking about the vulnerability in that piece. And it, I mean, I think it's a beautiful excerpt from the book. And, you know, talking about the novel, I'm talking about your poetry, too, that there's a love of beauty in the work, but a mistrust of beauty and a longing for beauty and the despicable nature of beauty, et cetera, and it just keeps rolling, a revolving spike of beauty. but there's
beauty and Beatty.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Direct relationship. But there's a great humanity under the lines of your work. I know that you're not as interested in the sense of the romantic that's underneath the lines, but can you talk about that tension?
That tension?
Between the romantic and the brutal.
Well, gee, no, I don't think so.
Okay, we'll talk about whatever you want then.
You know, I mean, most people think, the thing that strikes most people about the book is how obnoxious it is, not how beautiful it is. But I agree with you. I mean, I'm going for beauty.
Yeah.
but it is kind of, I mean, to take a little step into, you know, abstract territory, getting a little intellectual for a moment. The fact is that none of those kind of terms exist except in their relationship to their opposites, you know. I mean, beauty only exists because there's something that's not beautiful. And the further extreme you get in the direction of beauty, the closer it gets to the furthest extreme of ugly, until there's a point right where there's no difference between the really beautiful and the really ugly.
Right.
And so, you know, I'm going for that extreme.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Well, I mean, I think that's in your poetry, too, definitely. And one way of talking about it that makes sense to me is I think your poetry has a lot of burning guitars in it. You know, it's like burning the beautiful guitar and, you know, just flaming it up and having us enter a world where we're not sure what we're stepping into next. And I think that's a great thing in your work.
I don't know. Anything you can say to make people want to read the poems is fine with me.
Okay. Whether it's accurate or not.
Yeah. I don't know what to say about them, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't really have a lot of theories about it.
Okay. That's fine. Well, why don't you read
some? Except I noticed that you do like the sweet ones. You do lean towards the sweet ones.
Well, that would surprise many of my friends and colleagues, but well, I guess because I'm interested in that meeting place of the almost romantic and the brutal in your work, and it's a way to talk about that. But
okay.
Also, some of the ones that aren't so sweet, we can't read on the air. So,
right. Yeah.
So if you
there's
could,
that too. Yeah.
Could you read some poems?
Yeah, I'm reading the ones that you picked out as being your favorites, but also they're you know. They fit in the constraints of what can be read on the radio.
Right.
Okay, this one's called Kiss. These books, I mean, these poems are all from my book Hot and Cold, which is, it kind of, you know, I mean, it actually serves as a sort of selective poems up to the date it was published, which is 4 or 5 years ago. But it's a book that also has essays, it has all my lyrics to all my songs, it has a bunch of notebooks from the 90s and a lot of drawings and photographs in it, but it also has all the poems I thought might be worth keeping. And this one's called Kiss. You know, and they range way back. This Kiss was probably written in about late 80s. Kiss. Yellow and gray, the checkered cloth, each square its sculpture rising, hampered sunlight topiary of a tree-strewn slope. The trees can move, and their leaves touch your throat. I lift my arms, and lying on my back, I levitate with the laws of nature, thoughtlessly. The checkered ground, like a handkerchief lifted from its corners to enclose me, and the vivid taste of citrus radiates its own absorption from that spot upon the tongue, in ladder upon ladder, from whence I wave to you, hectically, abandoned, without a thought but to make you glad, way up there in the sky with your hair and turned away head in the foreground, looking at me as if I were your child, for which I'm grateful, deck after deck of cards sprung free, down around your feet and arms and knees and shoulders, all of which we can see, except our faces, because our eyes are in them. God, I don't know if I've ever read that, you know. I don't usually read these poems, you know, because I really write prose now. I mean, it's funny, because I don't read the poems, when I do read them like that, I hear all these things that feel clumsy to me. I mean, for a poem like this, it really belongs on the page. I mean, I don't know. Well, you know, maybe if I read it two or three times and got more used to it, I'd get more used to how it works read aloud. But but I find I don't really regard myself as a poet. I love poems, and when I was a kid, it was my ambition, my intention to make a life as a poet and have that be my main occupation, vocation. But I always loved poetry, and I think about it a lot. Well, because I read it a lot. I mean, I read my books. I have a huge collection of poetry. I go to used bookstores all the time looking for more of it.
Well, you sound like a poet. You talk like a poet. I love your poetry, so maybe it's just that you're not used to reading them out loud. But
Well, thank you. But I mean, what I'm getting at is that I finally just, I mean, I'm fixed on this route of writing novels because I find that I pretty much, from 99% of the way, can satisfy my urges to write as a poet within the novels because the novels are so elastic. You can do almost anything in a novel. I mean, this novel has poems in it, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of novels that have had poems in it, whether you're talking about, like Dr. Zhivago or Pale Fire, or think of Rilke's novel, which isn't poems, but it is a poetry.
Well, I mean, I think poetry can be elastic too. I mean, you could enclose prose in a poem. I mean, why not do that? You have some prose poems, a lot of which you can't read on the air, but could you read a couple more poems?
Okay. Yeah, I like the I mated these two, the one I just read and the one that follows it, because they both have yellow and gray in them. And this one's called Untitled. Off in the dusk at sea gather beautiful gray and yellow bobbing files of Bonhomie containers. A chick emerges from an egg. Cruelty gets a new definition. To be alive, yes, it does impart a responsibility to speak for the inanimate, and therein lies the irony. That singing bird is bursting with lust that feels like certainty. Ripe gray bananas, yellow dusk. I like gray and yellow.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I said gray and yellow bobbing files of Bonhomie containers. Do you know what Bonhomie is?
Is that a cleanser?
Yeah, it's a cleanser. Okay. And that's why I was picturing those. I mean, the image came to my mind writing that poem. And then I came across, I mean, I don't even know if they still make it. When I was a kid, there was Bonhomie.
I don't think they do anymore. I don't think they do.
But it had a little baby chick on the box. Mm-hmm. It was like the packaging. Mm-hmm. That was like the sort of symbol somehow.
Mm-hmm.
But then I saw in an old vintage magazine an advertisement for Bonhomie, and it's not gray and yellow, it's brown and yellow.
In your mind, it's gray and yellow. In the poem, it's gray and yellow. Let me remind our listeners where we are. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the writer and musician Richard Howe, reading some of his poems right now, but he was reading from his new novel, Godlike. So I know I'm pushing you to read some poems, but...
Keep going?
Yeah.
Okay. I know you picked all the most dramatic, sweet ones. I shouldn't keep stepping on you for that. After all, I wrote them. Gotta take responsibility for them. It's my own fault. It's called A Castle. Later, I stumbled onto the base of a pinnacle, peaked with pointed towers and swarming with flowered vines. It was dark and felt like rain. I climbed. The moon seemed so close I could smell it, and clouds blew across like water painting. My happiness was electric, beyond control. As I climbed, half with my hands, I felt as if I were sculpting the mountain. I took my hands away from the small of her back and then pressed her against me again, so conscious of the pure strength, I felt like a church and she was weightless. The castle, when I arrived, seemed as fragile as eggshell, but indestructible, and stood blue-gray as a delicate ship sailing into the dewy hour before dawn. It seemed to permit exploration, and so I made the pact and stepped carefully inside. Mm-hmm. These are all like, you know where all these poems come from. They come from when I just met a girl and was really, like, obsessed.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great.
Every one of them.
Yeah. It's in there. But, you know, there's this also this thing that you just sort of keep denying, which is, I mean, I think it's almost like a runaway train in your poems. There's all these things and jam lines, so we keep moving. And then there's a, like the bottom falls out, there's a, you know, what was that line? I felt like a church. Mm. It was a beautiful line in there. And so I think, I don't see them as that sweet. I see them as, you know, there's a bottom that falls out, and there's this. We're in another world. We don't know what's going to happen. Usually there's brutality. I mean, with the last poem with the chick, there was cruelty right after the chick showed up. So you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
You're not going for it?
No, I'm going for it.
Okay.
Okay, now here's the one. You have a double star. And I mean, of all the ones you pick, this one is the one that you like most enthusiastic about, and it's the one that makes me cringe the most. But at the same time, I can't deny that I meant every word of it. So I shouldn't like apologize or anything. This one's also entitled. I got up in the middle of the night to read a book, when really what I want to do is sing to you. To take these words and turn them around in such a way that they will make you glad, make you smile to yourself, maybe with your eyes closed, maybe even gasp and later gaze off into nowhere for the pleasure of remembering the way they made you feel. I don't know how, but that's what I'd like to do more than anything else, is sing through these words to you.
I think that's beautiful.
Thank you.
And it makes me, you know, think about the relationship between music and poetry also, and not necessarily talking about the music in poetry, but you know, your songwriting and writing songs. Can you talk a little bit about if there is a relationship between your songwriting and your poetry writing?
The way I feel about it, there's none. I mean, there's no closer than. Like climbing a mountain is to riding a bicycle. Not that one of those things is like the other. It's just two things you do with your legs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, writing a poem versus writing a song are like two things you do with words. But they're so entirely separate. I mean, you know, for me, in my experience, poetry came first. I was doing that before I was writing songs, and I was thinking about it and trying to figure out how it was done, and over and over, you know, writing new ones and finding a way to make it work for me. And I arrived at, you know, the certain methods and certain conceptions of what worked and what it meant. And then came songwriting, and that was entirely different because in writing the songs, in a way it was kind of fun because it filled up this whole area that this writing of the poems didn't. Because, I mean, as you know, poetry writing in the 20th century became really abstract, you know. I mean, the way people look at it and think of it, and I'm sure it's probably true, is that originally poetry was about, the whole form came from the need to find a way to combine words in such a way that they'd be memorable.
Mm-hmm.
It was about rhythm and rhyme. I mean, it was literally about to make them memorable way because people, it predated writing,
mm-hmm.
and it was oral. And it was about, these strict forms that were rhythmic and rhymed so that you could remember them
right.
for page after page after page. Mm-hmm. It was easy to memorize.
Mm-hmm.
Then with the advent of writing, poetry little by little became less and less about that and more abstract until you arrived in the 20th century where nobody ever rhymes and there's no rhythm. And
it's like
the equivalent of abstract painting,
yeah.
or jazz or something. You like just you tend to go on nerve, right? But when you're writing songs, it's like returning to that original
form.
Yeah, where it's very rhythmic and it rhymes. And I really had fun doing that and fun in my songwriting. There's really strict patterns coming up to fit with the music.
Right.
And I really enjoyed the making these intricate clockwork things that I also wanted to be packed with as much of the power of what words can do,
right,
just strictly as words, apart from being in with these little mechanisms, right? So they're entirely completely different.
Okay. We have time for just, I think, one more poem, if you'd be willing.
This is another untitled one. City first a stamped circuit on the face of a masked man. I saw a little horse go galloping across his eyes. Then I awoke without having slept, and all was still, exactly as before. And so I set out, a setter out of going, even better maybe spaced, yes, spacey into town, and light. It rolled by, spraying, turning that which touched it to itself, and nowhere in the course left bouncing things to go but math. Left bouncing things to go, but sky or space was what I saw, thought I. I cried that night, that poetry could clarify? No, he said, the answer's no, but he meant the opposite, or better put, the opposite was he, spigot, a word I got from this book I ordered, a first edition of Bill Knott's Autonecrophilia that turned out to have a damned previous owner's signature on the flyleaf. Then I had a great idea. I'll put it in a poem and make it better than without. The ballpoint pen writing on the flyleaf says Jeff Levitsky, 72.
The poetry of Richard Hell. Thanks so much for reading your poetry.
Sure.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Alan Wadey. Our sound engineers are Brian Saworek, Joseph Wilk, and Lauren Wolf. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, independent public radio, 91.3 WYEP.